It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, November 25th. I'm Phil Picardi with the podcast. Coming up, Minnesotans react to Ferguson. A former disgruntled Minneapolis police officer is now part of the administration. Rochester first responders have to respond to possible Ebola. E-pull tab sales perk up. State lawmakers hope they can avoid a government shutdown. Where do all the mattresses go? And a long-awaited true story hits the big screen. At least four rallies are planned in Minnesota in the wake of the grand jury's decision not to indict a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Those rallies were scheduled for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer has the comments of people who gathered when news broke there would be no indictment for police officer Darren Wilson. He's the cop who shot unarmed teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson back in August.
In North Minneapolis last night, about a dozen people gathered to watch the announcement of the verdict. Like many there, 52-year-old Sam Grant of St. Paul said he was disappointed but not surprised. Grant, who's African-American, says he fears people won't learn anything from the tragedy.
I'm worried about the divisiveness of this. I'm worried about us not capturing the moment to actually say, let this be the last time that we fail to actually, in a healthy way, practice due process that makes all people in America feel like we have a system that's working for all of us.
Grant says Brown's death and the grand jury's decision mark an ugly moment of painful division in the country. Even though the shooting has been a major news story for more than 3 months, Grant says few people really understand the day-to-day lives of young black men.
I think African-American men have a sense of what it means to be a black man in a metropolitan area. I don't think, except for black women, hardly anybody else truly has an understanding of that. I think we're still very divided in our understanding and our sensibilities about how we experience race. So, no, I don't believe that people get it. And that doesn't feel good to have that sense in the 21st century that we're still this far from getting it together.
When Tana Melikeen, who works with Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, says the shooting of Michael Brown has led her to think about how police in the Twin Cities would handle a similar situation.
What would happen if Ferguson was North Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, or East St. Paul? And it makes me wonder what we can do in Minnesota to strengthen our judicial system, to strengthen our police departments, to strengthen our city government so that we can have better results that are more reflective of what's the honest truth.
In a statement, Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto says it's important for the public to be heard on this matter and law enforcement needs public support to be effective. She says the department plans on assisting with this afternoon's demonstrations by rerouting traffic and providing logistical support if requested. But she's also asking the public to help maintain a, quote, safe and secure city in the wake of the Ferguson decision.
Kathy Werzer with the reactions of people in North Minneapolis. A Minneapolis police officer who once sued the department for discrimination will soon assume the high-ranking chief of staff position. First Precinct Inspector Madera Arredondo previously oversaw the department's branch that investigates officer misconduct complaints. His promotion is part of an ongoing effort by Police Chief Janae Harto to improve public trust. Tom Cran spoke with him for last night's All Things Considered.
I'm there really trying to make sure that the chief's message, vision, with our organization in terms of our public safety efforts, making sure that that communication is really getting out to all of our vested stakeholders out there in the community, but also, just as important, to make sure that that door of communication and that messaging is getting to our elected officials as well.
Does that mean that you are the conduit, if you will, or liaison between the department and the mayor and the city council? When I heard you say elected officials, or how will that work?
Yeah, well, certainly the chief has a very good relationship with our mayor and certainly our elected officials, but obviously with the amount of work that goes into the day-to-day operations of the department, the chief herself may not always be able to have a lot of those one-on-one sit-down meetings with the folks that impact certainly the work that we do. So in many respects, I'll be kind of her proxy in that regard and making sure that the communication, the messaging, certainly any new initiatives, policies, or for that matter, if there are critical incidents which occur in our city that certainly need folks to be aware of, that's what I'll be doing.
Now, we've been hearing a fair amount lately about tensions between officers and the administration. A couple of things that have risen to the top in the news. Five former high-ranking officers are currently suing the chief for age discrimination. There's been the whole issue that's been called Pointergate. Mayor Hodges saying recently here on NPR that she thinks that maybe the police union leadership used that Pointergate story as backlash against her push for more accountability, perhaps the officers wearing body cameras. Mayor Hodges is a strong supporter, she's told me personally here on NPR, of Chief Harto. But in your new role, are you going to be involved in soothing these larger tensions?
You know, one of the things that I've certainly prided myself on in my career over the past 25 years is I really believe the cornerstone to any type of success that we can have in the policing profession is really about relationship building. And so that's where I've been very fortunate over the course of my career in terms of whether it's our rank and file, certainly just as equally with our communities. I think that for us to advance any of our policies or measures which are really aimed at increasing the public safety of our city, I think all of those are important key players, and they all have to be at the table, and they all have to hear the same messaging, but they all also have to be listened to.
Both you and the chief in past years have fought the department for discrimination, and now you're at the top of the ranks here. So what does that tell us about how the department has changed in recent years? Can we draw conclusions from that?
Very good question, and I think it's really looking at if there are things within the organization that at times that need to be improved upon, need to be made aware of, and we can correct those, then that's a good thing. And every employee has the opportunity to contribute to making it worse or can contribute to making it better. And certainly myself, certainly Chief Harto, and there's many others, the vast majority of the men and women on the Minneapolis Police Department come to work each and every day committed to providing the best public safety service they can for the communities here in Minneapolis. And so we'll continue to build upon that, and that's certainly something that I will continue to do in my role.
NPR News has been given a number from the Minneapolis Police Department not long ago that 6% of the officers actually live in the city of Minneapolis. You yourself do. And I'm wondering, what difference does that make or would that make if more officers lived in Minneapolis?
You know, I have heard over the course of my career, many people in our communities, whether it's community meetings or different events, they feel that if there were more Minneapolis police officers that lived in their neighborhoods, that those officers would have a deeper connection in terms of the job that they do each and every day.
Inspector Arredondo, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Tom Cran on All Things Considered. The Rochester Fire Department initiated its Ebola response plan for the second time in a month after a man called 911 to report his wife was experiencing flu-like symptoms, but some important details of the call were lost in translation. Elizabeth Baer reports.
The Rochester 911 Center received a phone call Sunday morning reporting an emergency at a home in southeast Rochester. The caller told the dispatcher his wife had flu-like symptoms, fever, vomiting, chills. Deputy Fire Chief Steve Balow says the dispatcher asked some standard questions from the Centers for Disease Control.
Have you traveled to Africa within the last 3 weeks? And then if they say yes, then it gets refined further to West Africa and then to Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and now it's a fourth, including Mali.
That last country, Mali, was just added to the CDC's travel advisory list last week. Balow believes the caller thought the dispatcher was asking if his wife was Somali, and he said yes.
There was some confusion over Somali and Mali, so the dispatch communications that translated to the emergency responders was that they had someone with flu-like symptoms who had recently been to Mali.
A few minutes after the call, 12 first responders arrived at the home, four wearing biohazard protective gear. Once there, firefighters were able to re-ask the question a number of ways until the confusion was cleared up. The woman hasn't visited her home country for 2 years and has not been to Mali. Bailo says when language is an issue, dispatchers often ask to speak to English-speaking children or relatives. The city also subscribes to a service which connects dispatchers with interpreters by phone. But he says it's not always easy to access that service.
You have to know what language you're dealing with in order to make the request. And again, because of the communications, the language barrier that was present, it couldn't be ascertained what the country of origin was of the person who was making the 911 call.
State health officials say they have not received any requests from local dispatchers specific to language training or interpreter services. But they are monitoring approximately 75 people who have returned to Minnesota from Ebola-affected countries. The monitoring lasts 21 days, which is the incubation period for Ebola. But because Molly was just added last week, Bailo says it was possible the woman had traveled there but was not under the health department's surveillance. So was this a fluke? Maybe, says Bailo, but he says the potential exists for miscommunication between dispatchers and people with limited English skills. And because Minnesota's home to a large Somali population, he cautions other dispatchers and first responders to listen carefully when asking about Molly. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Remember electronic pull tabs, the new online gambling that was going to make enough money to cover the taxpayers' share of the Viking Stadium? Well, that didn't work out very well, but there are signs of a turnaround, and a big one. Tim Nelson has more.
We gave the bartender $20 each, and then now we're going to hit buttons and hope we win.
Welcome to the Fat Pheasant Pub in Windham, Minnesota. It's about 150 miles southwest of the Twin Cities, and it is right now pretty much the world capital of electronic pull tabs. That was Rory Johnson sitting with Tammy Roos and playing Nile Treasure, one of the new games that came online across the state in August.
Oh, Tammy. Oh, this is good. Look at that, 50 bucks. Look at this. $100! Look at this. 150!
Now wait for it.
Are you kidding me, Rar?
No! $400! Yeah!
But it isn't just Rory Johnson and Tammy Roos hitting the jackpot. This summer's reboot of the electronic pull tab industry has been followed by a surge in business. Gamblers were putting down an average of more than $4,200 a day at the Fat Pheasant last month. That's more than three times what gamblers were betting there in October last year, and more than anywhere else in Minnesota. Average daily revenue was up by nearly 50% through Halloween across the state. John Weaver was one of the founders who brought in the first version of e-pull tabs. His second try, Pilot Games, now runs about 60% of the electronic pull tabs taking bets in Minnesota.
From August 2014 till today, we've seen a 100% increase, you know, from $1 million in sales to about $2.1 million in sales projected for November.
And for the first time since the games debuted in September of 2012, e-pull tabs are starting to hit their financial targets, even occasionally far exceed them. 2 years ago, the devices were projected to take in $225 in bets a day, but the best games were taking in less than $60 a day this summer. Pilot's new games, however, took in an average of $240 a day for August, according to data from the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. Weaver credits better technology and better marketing for the success. He also credits a steady flow of new games.
Players, through paper pull tabs, they've been trained to want new games on a very consistent basis.
Still, the money is a far cry from the $100 million a month that the state was hoping for. Corporate taxes will still pay the state's stadium bills for now. Projections of 15,000 games in 2,500 bars are even farther off. The games are in less than 200 bars now. But good sales are already getting attention and may help spread the games more widely, considered a key factor in making the games a full-fledged successor to paper pull tabs. Keith Franke is mayor of St. Paul Park and owns Franke's Bar in what was once the town blacksmith shop in the shadow of the Northern Tier Energy oil refinery. He doesn't want to talk numbers, but says he's seeing a boost in his bottom line since the newest e-poll tabs arrived.
The Lions Club brought it up to me and said, you know, do you want to give these a shot? And I said, sure, let's try them. And as soon as they came in, the customers loved them right away, and it's just been a run ever since.
Which may finally mark a change of fortune for the pull tabs themselves. With reporting from Mark Stile, Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The state legislature doesn't begin its new session for another 6 weeks, but some lawmakers are already speculating about the potential for trouble under the new power dynamic. DFL Governor Mark Dayton and the DFL Senate must now work with the Republican House to craft a two-year budget. Despite early pledges of cooperation, some lawmakers are worried about a state government shutdown. Tim Pugmire reports.
Republican State Representative Greg Davids of Preston returns to a familiar role next year as chair of the House Tax Committee. He last held the title 2 years ago during a biennium that included a budget stalemate between Governor Dayton and the GOP majority that shut down government for 3 weeks in 2011. David said he's concerned it could happen again.
Well, it was a great political ploy by the DFL to regain the House in 2012. And so they may say, hey, that's how we could, take over the House again, just have a shutdown, blame it on the Republicans. I'm concerned about that.
David said he hopes he's wrong. He said he won't let his concerns get in the way of crafting a good tax bill that can pass in the House and Senate. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach has concerns, too. That's because there were problems the last time Minnesota had the combination of a DFL governor, a DFL Senate, and a Republican House. Bach said he's been researching the budget session of 1985, which was 10 years before he arrived at the Capitol.
I would characterize it to have been kind of a disaster. It did not go well.
Bach said lawmakers failed to pass any of their budget bills on time that year. They finished the job in late June during a 3-day special session. Bach called it a significant failure by that legislature.
My hope is that we can look back at that history. I've already told my leadership that I want a good summary written of that because I don't want to make the same kind of mistakes that were made in 1985. We have the Constitution says we meet from January through May, and my intent is to be done on our adjournment date in May.
The day after the election, Governor Dayton warned that a shutdown could happen again if Republicans are not willing to work with him. He said the new divided government is a prescription for gridlock unless they rise above it. Last week, Dayton was sounding a little more optimistic.
You know, the people of Minnesota have spoken. That's why we have elections. They've decided to want a Republican House and DFL Senate and DFL Governor, and we'll make that work as we need to for the sake of Minnesota, and we'll show Washington, D.C. how to do it right.
Republican House Speaker Designate Kurt Dowd of Crown said he hopes nobody wants a government shutdown. Dowd said he's surprised anybody is talking about one at this point.
If we focus on the problems that Minnesotans care about, and we focus on real solutions that will solve those problems, I don't see any reason why we would have a shutdown or why we wouldn't be able to work very well together. So I'm going to stick to that as we move through the session, and hopefully the Democrats will remain focused on that as well.
Lawmakers from both parties will have an easier time getting along if they have a budget surplus to work with. They'll find out more next week when state officials announce their latest economic forecast. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
U.S. Attorney Andy Lugar is asking Somali Americans for feedback on a new pilot program aimed at offering young people healthy alternatives to religious radicalization. Lugar told about 50 community leaders yesterday he wants to bolster youth and job training programs and reduce extra security hassles many Muslims face while traveling through the airport. Kamal Hassan of Edina says Lugar is trying to empower the Somali community so it is better equipped to address problems.
This is the first serious effort from the government to address the causes instead of dealing just with the symptoms. And I believe Washington should listen to him and, you know, fund his proposal.
Lugar says the program is separate from the government's investigation into the recruitment of about a dozen Minnesotans for radical groups in Syria. Minnesota's attorney general has issued a new report saying Savers is misleading the public about how much of the donations it solicits are given to local charities. Savers thrift stores collect donations on behalf of a half dozen charities including the Vietnam Veterans of America and the Epilepsy Foundation. Attorney General Lori Swanson says Savers is not disclosing its role as a professional fundraiser and its practice of only sending some donations toward charitable contributions.
You have choices. You can donate directly to a charitable organization that doesn't use a professional fundraiser, at which point really all of the money then stays with the charity and goes to benefit the charity. In this case, if you donate to a charity through Savers, only pennies on the dollar goes to benefit the charitable mission of the charity.
A spokeswoman for Savers says the company will continue to work with the Attorney General's office to quickly address concerns. A gorilla born last week at St. Paul's Como Zoo has died. Matt Sepik reports.
Senior zookeeper Allison Youngheim says the infant appeared healthy in the days after he was born, but became weak by Sunday morning and died. Youngheim says she suspects the baby gorilla had trouble feeding. She says the University of Minnesota Veterinary Clinic is performing a necropsy to determine the cause of death. Youngheim says it's a difficult time for both the staff and the animals.
We did let Alice and the rest of the family group of gorillas see the baby after it had passed, and I think that that's a good way for them to get through that grieving process and to really understand what happened to the baby as well.
The infant was the first gorilla born at the zoo in its 55 years of caring for the primates, but another baby is on the way. Dara, an 11-year-old, is expected to give birth at Como in the coming months. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
When Minneapolis residents throw out old mattresses, it costs taxpayers big money. The city, which collects the mattresses along with other recyclables, spends about $600,000 a year to dispose of them. That's why Minneapolis might ask the state legislature to create a statewide program for recycling mattresses. Curtis Gilbert reports.
Mattresses create lots of headaches for trash collectors. They're bulky and awkward to move. They don't like to stay buried in landfills because they're full of air. Instead, they slowly work their way to the surface, rising from the earth like zombies. They cause problems for trash incinerators, too, because the springs don't burn. Since 2012, Hennepin County has banned Minneapolis from dumping mattresses at the garbage-burning power plant downtown. So the city had to start recycling them. A lot of them.
We pick up over 34,000 mattresses a year from our residential collections.
Minneapolis Solid Waste and Recycling Director Dave Herberholtz says each of those mattresses and box springs costs about $18 to recycle. That's far more expensive than any other recyclable item the city handles.
With a collection of mattresses and then the value of the material that is actually recycled out of the mattress, it does not come close to offsetting the internal costs.
It's expensive because a mattress is like a layer cake. The only way to salvage the materials is to separate the layers. That's a time-intensive process. At Second Chance Recycling in Minneapolis, the average worker can dismantle about 35 beds per shift with the help of a utility knife. The most valuable part of the mattress by far is the steel cage of springs. They're strung together into trains, 12 beds long, and fed into a custom-built baling machine. The 250-pound bales will eventually get shipped out, sold, and melted down. The foam becomes carpet pads, and the cotton gets used in the oil fields of North Dakota to soak up small spills. Kevin Cannon supervises the nonprofit recycling operation.
There's a lot of hard work involved in this. It's dirty work, and the whole point of it is to keep stuff out of the landfill, and I don't know how you would do that without doing it by hand and separating out what you can sell and what's left over that can still at least be burnt for energy.
Most mattresses in Minnesota still end up in landfills. Recycling them is a relatively new idea. There are only a few dozen organizations doing it nationwide. But that's expected to change thanks to new laws that passed last year in three states, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and California. The laws, which will go into effect over the next 2 years, will tack a recycling charge onto the sale of new mattresses. In Connecticut, the first state to pass such a law, the proposed fee is $9 per mattress or box spring. That money would cover the cost of recycling the product when it reaches the end of its useful life. The International Sleep Products Association, a trade group for mattress manufacturers, helped craft the legislation in the three states. Vice President Chris Hudgens says supporting the recycling laws gave the industry more control over how the programs would work.
We wanted consumers to know what they're paying for. We wanted better awareness of the program. We want them to understand the process. And we also thought that the industry could run it better and at a lower cost than the state could.
Hudgens' group is focused on implementing the existing laws and isn't advocating for other states to adopt similar measures right away. But Minneapolis may start its push at the legislature anyway. The city council will decide next month whether to add mattress recycling to its lobbying agenda. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The highly anticipated film Foxcatcher opens tomorrow across the U.S. The film is based on a true story of Olympic wrestlers, a billionaire, and a murder. Director Bennett Miller, who also made Capote and Moneyball, told reporter Ewan Kerr the story of Foxcatcher is captivating.
Bennett Miller says he wanted to make Foxcatcher because the story just grabbed him.
I was very attracted to the notion of these two odd characters finding each other. It's one of the wealthiest men in America, John DuPont, heir to the DuPont fortune, and a struggling Olympic wrestler.
The wrestler, Mark Schultz, a skilled but socially awkward athlete, had been training in obscurity. Out of the blue in the film, he receives an invitation to DuPont's home on the Foxcatcher estate. After being picked up by the billionaire's private helicopter, Schultz meets DuPont, who introduces himself as a wrestling coach.
What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world. I want to go to the 88 Olympics in Seoul. I want to go.
Good. I'm proud of you.
Director Bennett Miller says the meeting began an all-too-familiar transaction. Someone with wealth and power latching onto a talented athlete. DuPont had built a training facility on the estate and brought in a number of wrestlers, including Mark Schultz's brother Dave. Miller says DuPont saw himself as the leader.
And part of the transaction was that everybody had to accept the charade. And he named himself head coach of guys who would be competing in the Olympics, knowing essentially nothing about the sport.
The movie follows the downward spiral of the three men's troubled relationships. It ends when DuPont shoots and kills Dave Schultz. Comedian Steve Carell plays DuPont as a patrician who believes the fictions built around him.
I am leading men. I am training them. I am teaching them. I am giving them a dream. And I am giving America hope.
A prosthetic nose makes Carell almost unrecognizable. Miller says the months of preparation that went into the makeup paid off in the way it transformed the actor and his performance. It even changed how the cast and crew treated Carell on set.
People tended to stay away from him. He really was sort of repellent in this makeup, in this getup, and it, I think, helped him with the role.
In the film, as in real life, DuPont became increasingly erratic, megalomaniacal, and ultimately murderous. Bennett Miller says he was careful, though, to make sure DuPont was portrayed as a man, not a monster.
You know, he did a monstrous thing. He killed somebody. But the film resists the temptation to make conclusions so that it could look more deeply into him and the story.
Miller praises Carell's preparation for the role and that of Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo as Mark and Dave Schultz. Foxcatcher won Miller the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival, and there is Oscar buzz about the film and the actors. Miller says he just wanted to tell the story right.
I think I and the actors both felt some kind of weight, you know, the weight of responsibility to honor the truth of what happened.
Miller says he just hopes that audiences will be as mesmerized as he was when he first heard the story. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News Update podcast for Tuesday. I'm Phil Picardi. All of the Wednesday news right back here Thanksgiving Eve.